Hello, hello. Welcome to season four of Philippine X in Wellness. Thank you all so much, really, just for being a part of our Philippine X in Wellness podcast journey. We can't thank you enough for tuning in and really being a part of just this transformative journey around talking, listening, and healing. We also want to thank, you know, our Philippine X supporters. You don't have to be Philippine X or Filipino to listen or view any of our episodes. A lot of times what we talk about in wellness also relates to you wherever you're at, whatever you identify. So you are also welcome to. I wanted to mention there are some changes in season four. We've taken out our break track. So we wanted you to still continue supporting our Philippine X, Filipino musicians and artists out there. Thank you all so much who have given us your consent to feature your music. We hope that as a community that you continue to purchase their music, go to their shows and support them, because without art, you know, that's just another avenue of wellness for many of our community, our creative outlets as well. I want to make sure that we honor that, even though we are moving from that format and having those break songs. We are also wanting to introduce you to our first episode of season four. We're interviewing Emerald Rubio, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we are going to talk about a very serious topic in our community: healing from sexual trauma in observance of Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month. I wanted to, before you start this episode, to go over a trigger and content warning. I wanted to let you all know that this episode is created for adult audiences only. We are going to talk about trauma, sexual abuse, and assault. So please take a break between the episode when you need to take your own wellness breaks. Take notice of what you're feeling emotionally and physically in your body. If you can't complete the episode, we will honor that and where you're at. We also have time frames at the end of, in the captions of YouTube. So if you want, you can also see those topics, and you can also choose what you would like to focus on in the episode and also what to avoid. But we wanted to let you know that this is a very sensitive topic for many people that will be listening. So without further ado, please prioritize yourself first. Look into the resources that we have in our Instagram highlights that will help you navigate your own wellness and mental health journey as we address these sometimes very difficult and deep and personally intense topics, okay? Otherwise, we hope that you also grow in wellness with us through this episode. Maayong adlaw, welcome back to Philippine X in Wellness's initial episode of season four. We are continuing this season with additional episodes around health and wellness topics for and by our Philippine X Filipino community, inclusive of our larger community of supporters. Thank you for watching and listening out there. I am your host, Cheryl Sampson Ramirez, and my pronouns are she, her, sha. Following our season three finale on Abilities Advocacy with Roque Bukton, we will be talking with licensed marriage and family therapist Emerald Rubio about healing from sexual trauma in observance of Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month. Before we jump in, a note on our content. This episode is created for adult audiences only. We advise our viewers and listeners to exercise discretion as we discuss trauma,
sexual abuse, and assaults. It might be a lot to take in, so if you need a breather, take a break or pause the episode before continuing further in order to help apply healthy boundaries. Please check the show notes on our YouTube channel for more detailed descriptions to avoid sections that may be triggering. Please take care of yourself, and if you need to, don't be afraid to reach out and ask for help. We have resources in our Instagram highlights, and hopefully you will find what you need there. As mentioned in previous episodes, all views discussed are for informational and educational purposes only. It's not meant to be medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare practitioner for your particular condition, especially before starting any exercise or new health program. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the podcast, Emerald Rubio. Welcome, Emerald.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl. It's an honor that you would even invite me into your space, so thank you so much.
Well, we're honored to have you and just to have you share your story with us. So, Emerald, we typically like to start by knowing where our guests are from. Let's start with, where are both sides of your family from, and where are you currently streaming from?
Okay, so, both of my family, so on my father's side, he's from Central Luzon, and so he's in a province called Zambales. They would say that's like the Santa Cruz of the Philippines. It's nice. There's a lot of beach towns, a lot of palenques, and I love it there. When I go to the Philippines, I don't like to go to the big cities. I like to go to the provinces. I like to go where the rice fields are. So that's where my family is at. My mom, she's in Central Luzon, in Tarlac. And so there's a lot of farmland or rice fields. There's a pond in the backyard where the tilapia is. There's coconut trees. And so that's more my jam when I get to go back home. And I'm streaming from San Jose. People will call that, the Silicon Valley, the Bay. And so it's like tech town. I'm Emerald, and my pronouns are she and her.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I get it. My parents are also from the province, and I'm with you. It just seems like the pulse is in the province, right?
Yeah. That's kind of my dream of where it can just like reside, because it's so good for your natural, your central nervous system. Like I actually like slow pace living.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
So now that we know your lineage and where you're based, Emerald, let's dive into the topic at hand, healing from sexual trauma. This is a heavy and very sensitive topic for many. So, Emerald, what is your personal story, and what got you on the path towards healing from sexual trauma?
Oh, my goodness. I'm the eldest of five, and if you can imagine being in a household of five girls, immigrant family, mother and father, and also it was multi-generational, so we always had people in the house, whether it was like grandparents, extended family. And so it was quite like the hustle and bustle life to have a mortgage and five kids, and then also to support, the collective, support people whoever's in the household. And so that was a heavy toll on my parents. And, I grew up where there was a lot of domestic violence, and so they didn't really handle, their stress really well. There's a lot of domestic violence in the home. That physical abuse that came, trickled down towards us, a lot of emotional abuse that we had to endure. And because they literally came from the mindset, like, you just have to make it happen, very hustle and bustle, go, go, go. And that's how it is in the Bay. And so we had to, we had a lot of babysitters. There were cousins, aunties, and uncles, and most of them were very safe for the most part. But really, we had an uncle that lived with us for about 12 years. I was age, from 0 to 12, he lived with us. And it was, my dad's cousin. And he seemed like the fun uncle, like the uncle that would bring us to McDonald's, to bring us to Happy Hollow, the parks, that would bring us out swimming. But it just got really unsafe where he started to groom us. And unknowingly groomed me and my two other sisters for how many different years, and to the point where we actually got to gain our justice as of last month. I can't believe it's going to be a month. So, you know, we got to gain justice from the things that he did to us 30 years ago.
So, Emerald, if I may, I wanted to ask, so to clarify, were you born in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I was born in the U.S. My parents immigrated here when they were in their teens.
Okay, and then, so when, in what age range are you now?
Right, I'm proud. I'm 38. I'll be turning 39 in 2 months.
Okay, just to get, like, the idea of also the ages that you're referring to. And then also, maybe could you define for our community what grooming is?
Yeah. I mean, grooming is when someone just gradually tries to press those boundaries, you know, for a certain agenda. So for us, he was grooming us so that he was able to fulfill his own, you know, his own sexual desires. And that's just, it's wrong, it's unsafe, it's inappropriate, it's a crime. And so, you know, it started off like, you know, by the age of 7, it started off like tickle bites and, you know, kind of grazing over our body when we're in the, you know, in the swimming pool. And then it just got slowly more aggressive where, okay, I'm trying to take a shower or a bath. And then right after I get out of my bath, he's pulling me into his room so that he could help me lotion my body. But I'm 7. I could do this myself. And so I remember so vividly all these different boundaries that I would try to set with him. Like, no, I could do it myself. I don't need your help. And he would continue to insist on these things. And so it was so confusing to have this man, you know, just kind of fondle over you. And, you know, by age 8, he was so conniving. You know, in our home, I was either dodging physical abuse from my dad or the emotional daggers from my mother. Mm-hmm. And so if I had to choose that, being beaten and berated over, you know, hiding out in my uncle's room so I could do my homework, that's what I chose. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, second, third year old, you know, grade Emerald, that's the choice that I had to make. And I didn't think like, okay, if I do my homework in my uncle's room, I'm going to be sexually molested. That wasn't my thought. I just wanted to be safe from being beaten with hangers and, you know, whatever object that they decided to use. And, you know, he used that as an opportunity to try to set this mood. It was just really creepy. You know, he would play love songs in the background or right after homework. He would like he would pull me onto the blankets to fondle me and caress me and molest me. And, you know, at that point, I'm like, I'm just frozen. I don't know what the heck is happening or what's going on. So I'm literally just frozen. But I'm also terrified because this man is, you know, I'm 7 and he's 20. He's like late 20s. So it's terrifying. Like, how do I even begin to stand up for myself now? Mm. And, you know, it became a daily thing where it was like, you know, during the times that I was there doing homework, he used that time to, okay, I'm gonna pull her into my blankets, cuddle with her, and just start to fondle over her, you know, over and under her clothes. And so this was something that became like a very sick norm, you know, like his little daily escapades with me. What was really terrifying was when, you know, he became so bold and to where it became like night escapades. So he would carry me out of my bedroom, and I shared her bedroom with, you know, all my sisters. There's 2 bunk beds. And so I slept on the bottom one. And so he would carry me into his room, and I remember my toes dragging along the, you know, the textured walls. I remember waking up under the mothballs, you know, smell, and it was like a musty blue and yellow blanket. There are times I would wake up and I could just feel his erection on me. The most terrifying experience was I was asleep and I opened my eyes and I saw that I've been, I'm fully naked and I have, you know, My legs are spread and I see his face like 1 inch away from my private parts with a flashlight. And then so no one prepped me on what to do in those situations. So I'm, you know, whenever I would wake up to these instances, I would just kind of like clench my whole body and move around to try to stop whatever he was doing, but it didn't seem to stop. And what was angering was that as a therapist now, I saw all the signs, like you're obviously being abused and you don't see it. You don't see that your third or fourth grade child is wetting the bed. You don't see that she's literally screaming all over the house and having nightmares and trying to escape through, you know, the windows and the doors. And so it just, you know, I had to do my own healing work of forgiving my parents because they really had no idea. You know, immigrant Filipino families, they weren't taught, hey, what are the red signs of what to look for when your daughters are being molested? Like, they didn't know. They were just busy surviving. And so I endured that, like these daily things and nightly things. And it just, it made it really confusing. Like, what is safety even mean? What does love even mean? Because here's this man who's doing this to me. And at the same time, he's saying, I love you, right? I love helping you, right? Do you love me, right? And so, and I think those are words I did not hear from my parents. They didn't tell me that they loved me. And it's not that they didn't, it's just that they didn't express it. So, you know, it just really distorted this whole idea of what love, safety, security, and boundaries were. And so it, all of this mess did not even begin to decrease until he started dating. So when I hit middle school, he started dating someone, and you know, it started to kind of dwindle down to like a little fondle over, you know, just in passing, maybe like a graze over my chest. But it wasn't as nearly as traumatizing it was, you know, being trapped in his room and having to endure all these disgusting things, all these crimes. And so that part of my life ended at the age of 12 when he moved out. And I thought that really was the end of it. Like I could heal, you know, I could move on, I could heal now. And so, like, as I was writing this and as I was reflecting on it, I really was like in this whole fawn response. I kind of just went along because I was really scared. And so when I hit middle school, I was just in this whole freeze response. I became such a turtle shell of myself. I mean, if you had met that girl, like who I was before all of this happened, I was so silly, I was playful, I loved learning, I love reading, I was a top student. And then all of a sudden, like, I'm barely getting by with like B's, C's, and D's, and I'm literally dissociating all of class in middle school. I can't keep up with six classes. I don't know what the heck is going on, and I'm falling further and further behind. And I'm just, you know, feeling so depressed. And I just get to this point where like I have so much self-hatred because I feel ashamed, I feel disgusted, and I feel dirty, and I felt really just confused. And, you know, and then something starts to outbreak, because when these things happened, it's not just like, you know, mental manifestations, but you can also get physical symptoms. So for me, I was always constipated. I used to have eczema just on the crevices on my arms, but then now I start to get eczema like all over my face, my neck, all over my arms, all over my legs. And this was not something that I dealt with. And so, like, not only am I dealing with my own shame about what happened, and I don't even know how to process it because there's nobody to talk to, mm-hmm. I have to deal with the physical manifestations that I have rashes all over my body. So here I am, this, you know, scared middle schooler, and I just don't want to be seen and I don't want to be heard. And so I don't talk. And I just remember, you know, I would just wear my big baggy black hoodies, and just I would look down, and sometimes I didn't even cover my face because I was just that ashamed. And unfortunately, you know, with a lot of the poor boundaries that were happening in the house, you know, I had a grandmother who watched softcore, you know, I don't know why she did it, but it was I'm sorry, but that's hella Busto Scrum. I know she's like in heaven right now, but like that's hella Busto. She watches like softcore porn or like those rated NR videos, from Blockbuster. I'm like, this is so nasty. I don't know why you're watching this.
Was she related to your uncle?
Yeah, she was.
Oh.
But I love her. But I just remember, like, she had that. And then my dad had pornography. And I think I just started to find an outlet towards pornography. And that's, you know, it kind of started this whole, like, 12-year addiction where I would use pornography as a way to, like, release and just have some sort of, you know, comfort because I didn't know how to cope with any of this. You know, you're 7 years old and your uncle does this disgusting ongoing chronic crime towards you, and it just distorts everything. It distorts reality on so many different levels. I found that open door through pornography. And I just quietly, in silence, dealt with it. And, you know, when I hit high school, I kind of shifted into, like, you know, I went from fawn mode and then I went to freeze mode. I'm just going to deal with it by myself. Like, you know, and I remember even in middle school, just not wanting to look at myself, feeling so shame of when I had my period. Like, I had so much shame about just being a person, a woman. And so in high school, I got tired of it. Like, I'm tired of being the quiet girl. I don't want to be the quiet girl. And, you know, that's when I got into, like, fight mode and fly mode. And I just became, like, this rebel. And education was not a priority for me. In fact, my number one priority was, like, I better snag someone. I don't care who it is. If it's a girl or if it's a guy, like, I just need someone to rescue me. And so with every person that I was with, you know, I became such a chronic relationship jumper at age 14. Once I hit ninth grade, like, if I'm just good enough, and if I just, like, behave enough, if I'm like more as eccentric enough, maybe one of these families are going to adopt me. And it's kind of silly to think, but, like, that's what I thought. Like, that's my mindset. And so, you know, I ran away a lot. And, you know, when the relationships didn't work out, I felt such rejection. You know, and I became very, very suicidal. It went from, like, porn to now, like, now I'm having suicidal ideation and I'm having a lot of self-harm. And then I'm running away to the next person. Like, who's going to give me even just a crumble of attention so that I can see if they'll want me? And I just, all I wanted was just to feel loved. I just wanted someone to love me. I just wanted to feel safe. And I wanted, you know, I just wanted to belong to someone, and I wanted to have, like, that safe home environment. And so it wasn't until, like, my 20s, you know, that's what, at this time. And so this whole time, I'm not dealing with any of the sexual trauma. In fact, I'm just getting into even more sexual trauma because, you know, all this relationship jumping and running away, you know, I found myself getting into even different types of rapes. If I'm going on a first date with someone and then I would get raped, I would meet someone at school and I decided, okay, I'll go to your house. I don't want to go to my house. Why would I go to my house? It's not safe. So I'll go to your house. And then, you know, then experience being drugged or I'm drinking and I don't have the inhibition to even make a choice. And it's just, so I found myself in these types of situations or, hey, I need a ride home because I ran away, and what can I exchange or what can I offer you so I can get a ride home because I don't want to get beat when I get home. And so I didn't really know how to make a safe choice. I was just trying my best to survive the situation. And so in my 20s, you know, when I met, like, my husband now, we've been together since we were 20, but he, you know, it, like, all these, you know, little different way, maladaptive ways that I've coped, they were just only making it, it was only prolonging my healing process. And so, you know, he introduced me to the world of, like, drugs and raving and partying and alcohol and all of that. And that just, oh my goodness, that just covered everything even more. And, you know, the very thing that I was trying to run away from, I was trying to run away from a home that was unsafe. I was trying to run away from all the domestic violence. I was trying to run away from all these creepy people that didn't know how to respect those boundaries, you know, and then I found myself emulating the very thing I was trying to run away with. So became aggressive in my relationships. And it was just a very domestically violent, you know, relationships that I would have, or, you know, having poor boundaries. Well, you know, and the men, the Filipino men in my life, you know, I saw abusers, I saw cheaters, I saw people who were aggressive, I saw people who didn't know how to respect boundaries. And so that became manifest into my life where, yeah, like having intimacy and you're just emulating porn, but it's not real intimacy because you're just going through the motions and you're pretending to be someone else that you're not. So you're not really being connected, right? Or having poor boundaries. Well, I'm mad at you, so I'm just going to go to the club. Or I'm mad at you, I'm just going to go do drugs. I'm mad at you, so I'm just going to go talk to some other people on the DMs. You know, doing things that I saw all throughout my life growing up. And what really finally, you know, my rock bottom, where I was like, okay, I can't do this anymore. I was when I was 28. So about, 10 years ago, actually it was 2013, around this time, I made decisions that I lost my friends. I lost my family. I lost my kids for 24 days. You know, I made decisions that just destroyed all of that. And at the time, I was so bitter because I felt like I'm just, you know, everyone's rejecting me. They don't understand me. They just want to leave me. But really, that became the biggest blessing in my whole healing journey, because finally, I was able to just be alone with myself and to find safe communities that could help me along the way. And so that was like my biggest wake up call, to finally look myself in the mirror. And I'm like, I don't want to be aggressive. I don't want to be abusive. I don't want to just give my body because that's what I think I need to do to get love. Like, I want to have intimacy where we get to be, you know, it's collaborative, where we both have a choice, where it feels good, where it feels connected, not because it's transactional. You know, I just want people, I want to feel unconditionally loved as I'm growing and as I'm healing. And so it was through that. I mean, so before 28, I had, you know, my healing journey was like, it was like very short spurts of school counseling, short spurts of community agency, you know, short spurts of Kaiser. And then, you know, I had a season of going to like Incest Anonymous, because I was just really desperate. Like, I didn't know like what else I could turn to. Right. And so, I think, it just, I had this big like shift. Like, once I started to do the work, because and this is not because, I'm doing the work because someone told me to. It's like, I was so desperate. I didn't want to be this person anymore. And so I got myself in, it's called Gronowski Center. And it essentially, it's like a counseling center that was at Palo Alto University. And it was through that journey that I'm like, I'm ready. My therapist asked me, like, what do you want to do? Like, you know, you're a single mother, you're in transition, this fork in the road, like, what do you want to do? And I looked at him like, I want to do what you're doing. I want to help people. I'm like, I know I'm not there yet, but I want to. I kind of realized, like, through everything that I've been through, you know, it was like a tick mark of, okay, all the things that I could, like, I didn't read it in a book. Like, I literally lived through it. Like, I remember, you know, being in 5150. I remember getting taken away from the cops so I can go get assessed. I remember being in a group home and realizing, like, I don't like this system. I remember at age 17, I don't like this system. I want to create a better system. When I get to the other side, I want to do it different. And so it just became this full circle moment. Like, okay, I got that dream when I was age 17 that I wanted to become a therapist. Now I'm 30, like, I think I want to like take this jump and do it. And so when I went into grad school, I call it like, well, it is the most expensive therapy that you'll ever receive, because, man, you are just opening up all the boxes, like every single class. And so there are times where I'm just like literally crying in class, and then I'm like trying to process it with my husband and my kids and my friends. I'm like, you know, and like learning how to, I just, when I went to grad school, like, I can't believe all the things that I didn't like have access to, that I didn't understand.
Like, yeah, I didn't know that. No, totally.
To learn all these things.
Emerald, do you mind if we take a pause?
Yeah.
Wait, first let's take a breath, because I'm going to go back and circle back to your grad school point. But I also want to just take a pause because there are also members of our community that are listening to your story and also members of our community that are not in clinical practice. So if I can just draw some clarifying questions for the rest of our community. So because earlier on you mentioned like night terrors. Can you maybe explain when you were a child what night terrors were for maybe people that maybe have an idea, but they're not quite sure?
Yeah, so night terrors are these nightmares. Like, they're not just like sleeping in your bed. Usually people are acting things out. And the thing is, like, people don't always remember that they're acting things out. And so in my mind, what I remember was I had a recurring nightmare where I'm like essentially falling from like this white sky, and then my body drops, and it's like on that like circle, you know, like it's like a circle wooden spinning contraption, and I'm just like I'm feeling so dizzy and nauseous because it's spinning and spinning, and my arms and my legs are trapped, and I can't get out.
Yeah,
but on the other side of it, my mom and my dad were telling me like, you don't remember trying to jump out the window. You don't remember I tried to like hold you back because you tried to run out the door. You don't remember you screaming. And I don't remember any of that.
So this is when you were fully asleep that you were experiencing these?
Yeah.
Moments? Okay.
So this was between fourth and fifth grade, which made sense because that's when the, you know, the sexual trauma that I endured became more intense because it was on a daily basis, and then he was pushing things to the night. And so
thank you. You also mentioned 5150. Can you also explain to our community what is a 5150?
Yeah, so that's so if there's any, if anyone is showcasing any safety concerns, whether it's like you know, suicidal thoughts, homicidal threats, or just anything where your safety is being, they want to do like a 3-day psychiatric hold. And sometimes that can be longer. You know, they're really, when you go into these places, they're looking to see, well, can you keep yourself safe? Or are you going to be a threat to the community? So are you going to be a threat to yourself or the people around you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in case people are listening and they might know someone that's in a similar like position, where is there a number that you might want to recommend for 5150?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest one, I mean, I know that they have the suicide hotline for 988, but really, people can voluntarily, I know that, you know, if you really feel like you're not able to keep yourself safe, you can voluntarily bring yourself to the hospital and tell them what you're thinking and that you need that extra help, you know, or you could let a family member know so that they're able to take you there.
Okay, no, thank you. I wanted to take a pause and mention those important pieces just because I feel like those were really pivotal points in your upbringing that our community should be aware of, in case they know someone that's experiencing the same. So thank you for allowing me to take that pause and just clarifying some of those important points that you were sharing with us. So I want to bring it back also to now you're in grad school. Now you're mentioning learning all of this terminology, all of these concepts, all of these theories and interventions, right, around what you might have experienced. So where would you like to take it from there?
I mean, at that point, gosh, as hard as grad school was, because it was a 5-year journey, like, I'm so thankful for it, because then it helped me to like create a groundwork on how to create safety, you know, when I am working with people. Because one of the biggest is an insecurity. It's like, I remember even like raising my hand and telling the whole class of like, how can I be a therapist? Like, I don't have boundaries. And you want me to teach other people to have boundaries? Like, I don't have a boundary, you know? And there's a lot of like chuckles and laughs because there's a lot of people that also resonate like that. So in the Bay Area, it's hella diverse. So it was such a colorful classroom. And so a lot of us, we're all, you know, survivors of all types of different traumas. And so
right.
them could relate and we're in good company. And so we got to do a lot of practice around that. Like, how do you begin to assert what you need? How do you become so real about what you want for your life, what you want in your relationships, what you want in your friendships? Like, what? Now you have a choice? Like, that's crazy. And so all these things that I got to learn, like, well, you can have choice in how, like, the people around you or your career or your beliefs or...
Yeah. Agency.
It's just a wild concept. You don't have to sell for what is given. Like, you actually can choose.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, an exciting revelation that I got, like, during grad school. And I do use those concepts, like, in my healing circles, because a lot of them, they don't know. Like, survivors don't know that they can have a choice to say no, or they can end a friendship or a relationship or a job. And so that was really monumental for me in grad school.
So those were some transformative years for you when we talk about your healing from these sexual experiences. But also, you know, boundaries, it sounds like also were not clearly defined for you as a child, right? We're looking at this, I'm looking at and thinking about this generation of my friends raising their kids, where they're teaching their kids consent, right? Mm-hmm. And even consent around, can you post a picture of them on social media?
Right.
Or when we give our relatives kisses on the cheeks or give them hugs, you can tell them that you don't want that if you are not feeling comfortable. You know, I experienced that with my friend's kids recently. And while I was initially shocked because that's not something culturally that I'm used to, I actually respected that they were teaching their kids that to vocalize consent, you know, and not forcing their kids to have to, you know, give someone a kiss on the cheek or a hug, especially if they don't know them, right?
Right. And I love navigating that, you know, those kind of discussions with parents too, because so often we're not taught, like, hey, what's the difference between what's okay, you know, with strangers, acquaintances, friends, close friends, family members, yourself, your immediate family, you know, what do you feel comfortable with? And so, you know, especially in communities of color, that can be kind of tricky to navigate because, oh, if I don't hug you, that's seen as disrespectful. And it is right. Like, I'm learning that. Like, no, it's not disrespectful. It's, I get to choose what I'm comfortable with, and I don't feel comfortable hugging you, but I'll wave at you, or I'll give you a fist bump, or I'll give you a high five, or we can have our own little, like, you know, handshake, but I don't want to do a full body hug, or I don't want to, like, kiss you on the cheek. And so I think that's the beauty of, like, getting to the other side of this, getting to navigate that, like, not only with my own kids, they're teenagers now, but equipping other parents on how to have those conversations. And, you know, I was that school counselor that was doing social emotional lessons, talking about, you know, what is consent, body autonomy, and, you know, as simple as, like, oh, well, is it okay if I play with you? Oh, no, okay. And respecting a boundary, like, no, I don't have to play with you, or no, we don't have to share this bucket if I'm not comfortable. I want to be by myself. And so I think those were some rewarding moments of, like, man, I'm so glad that I decided to, like, that I didn't give up, that I didn't, that no, you know, none of those past suicide attempts, like, went through, that I'm breathing, I'm alive, so that I'm able to, like, empower other people, because it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, I hear that. So we probably also have people in our community maybe that are watching or listening that are wondering,
were your parents present, right, when all of this was happening? Like, were they aware? Which leads us kind of to my next question. So how did your family and close friends respond to your experiences of sexual trauma? And when and how did they find out?
Yeah. So my mom went to my final court date last month, and I did ask her that. And I've asked her many times, but I just, you know, I did ask mom, like, Mom, were you aware, like, of the creepy vibes? Like, did you pick up anything? And she said, no, she just really had no idea. My dad, he worked every single day. They worked, you know, they've always had businesses, whether it was like insurance or real estate. And so they're gone a lot of the time and they just had no idea. And so I actually told my mom when I was 19, and we were having one of her fights. She was berating my sister and she was slut shaming me. And I had just reached my breaking point with her. And that's when I was yelling at her, and I decided, like, you know what? Do you know why I'm like this? It's because of what uncle did to me. And so at that point, she was so frozen and she was crying. And she texted my uncle and said, I will never speak to you again. So that was at 19. I told my dad, I wanted to tell him earlier, but he just, you know, wanted to talk in person. And so I got to have this in-person conversation with my dad in 2017 when I went to the Philippines. And, you know, it was this four hour long conversation. And it wasn't just about what happened, you know, the sexual trauma. It was about everything.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to have this whole conversation about, like, the abuse.
What period or what age were you when you had this conversation with your dad on the timeline? So you said you told your mom when you were 19?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you were in your 20s already.
So with my dad, if that was 7 years ago, okay. So like 31, 32.
Okay. Was this when you were in your grad school years or before that? Okay.
This is in my grad school years.
Okay.
I asked him every question that I had always wanted to ask, like, you know, about the domestic violence, about why he wasn't there. And, like, you know, like, I wanted you there. Like, why did you cheat on my mom? Like, all the questions that I had just boiling in there. Like, I just asked him, you know, and it was such an escalating conversation. It was like shouting and then de-escalation and then crying and laughing and, you know, and then all to say that I finally told him what his cousin had done. And he was like, I'm going to effing kill him. And he was screaming at the top of his lungs. And for some people, that can be really terrifying. But for me, it was like, I felt that so endearing. Like, you know, because, like, for the first time, like, okay, my dad's going to protect me. He didn't do that. He's not going to do that. This uncle's in jail. Nothing's going to happen. But I just, you know, for the responses of my parents to, like, believe me. And so that meant a lot to me. But everybody else, I would say, you know, I don't know if you know this, but in 2020, they changed the rules of when you can come forward and where your perpetrator can be prosecuted in jail. And so there used to be a statute of limitation where you could only come out if it's by your 26th birthday. And they extended it to 40th birthday. So in 2020, when those laws changed, that's when I decided to report this case, because I knew that this man had kids and they were the same age as my kids. So that was a haunting fact. And so yeah. I put my story on social media. So that's how the rest of my family knew. And I got a lot of support.
Including her four sisters.
Hmm?
Is that how also you mentioned your family of five, all girls? So your four sisters also found out that way?
No, I would say this is how my extended family found out. With my sisters, so when we were 14, or when I was 14, 15, my grandmother got diagnosed with cancer. And so we were at the hospitals a lot. And there was this moment where we're waiting in the hospital, and I decided to ask them, like, hey, what's your deepest, darkest secret? And we all admitted to each other that our Uncle June had molested us. And we all just started to like compare stories, like, no way, what? You too? And so that was the first time that we found out that he had molested the three of us. He didn't molest the last two, it was just the three of us. And so those are the three. It was me, my two sisters, that we fought in court for justice and got justice last month.
And you said this was during your teenage years when you all found out?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you exchange those stories, were they happening at the same time when you were all in the same room or?
No.
I mean, I get it because you didn't know about each other.
No. He met, that was the crazy part. There were so many people in the house. Like, how did he manage to keep this? How did he keep this under wraps? But this, and, you know, and working in this area, most of my clients are survivors, and this happens a lot within families where they keep it under wraps, and it's generationally. You know, it's the uncle, it's the grandpa, it's the family friend, it's the yaya, it's the nanny. And this is all happening under the home.
Did you find out, were there other family members outside of your nuclear family that were also victims or maybe aware that this might was going on, or was most of the family shocked?
Yeah, all of the family was shocked. They couldn't believe it because, you know, yeah, they couldn't believe it. Like, the persona that my uncle had put, like, he's just helpful. He was like the handyman, you know, he was the babysitter. So, no.
And then when the news got out, what was your uncle's initial reaction?
When he was crying, from what I was told, he was crying. And he actually wrote a letter to me and my two sisters. And it said, you know, I'm sorry for what I did to your understanding. And then he put all three of our names and his name. And so because he did that he incriminated, you know, he pretty much incriminated himself. And that's what got him arrested, because then they used that as evidence. When, so, you know, September 2020, I made the report. And then January 2021, that's when he was arrested. And so he's been in jail ever since. And so when we went to our last court date last month, they sentenced him to 28 years in jail.
Wow.
And that's beyond, you know, it's an honor to even get to that point. And this is what I teach to my survivors. Like, out of 1,000 people that come forward, and just think of all the people that don't come forward. Out of 1,000 people that come forward and actually report, 13 will make it to, like, okay, we're going to take it on as a case. And out of the 13 that get taken on as a case, 7 of those will get be convicted.
Right.
And so I just think about all the people that don't even come forward.
No, right.
So we were the, you know.
Yeah. Was there any news of his, you mentioned he has children, of them also being victims?
That we don't know.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when we talk about abuse, when we were preparing for this show, Emerald, we were talking about also how abusers oftentimes were also victims themselves. Right. And I asked you if your uncle was also a victim.
And I actually asked him that during, you know, my last court date. Because, you know, on your last court date, you can make a victim witness statement, impact statement. And so this is where you get to share the impact of what they did, but also to ask them questions. And that was one of my questions, like, why? I want to understand you. Why did you do this to me? And it's not that I want to, you know, I just want to understand you so I can further extend my forgiveness to you. Because I just want to know why. Like, I've been wondering this whole time. And he chose not to answer. So that I'll never know.
And the legal process, was it a lengthy process? Was there, talk a little bit about that. How was it, were there a lot of complicated hoops to jump through?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so it was a 4-year process. They told us it was going to be a year and a half. Because of the pandemic and there was a backlog, we had to wait so many times. There were times that we would go to court or, you know, and I wanted to go to court because I wanted to understand what this whole system was. And I wanted to see, are they really protecting the survivors or the perpetrators? So I did go to a lot of the court dates. And so it was a lot of continuance. And so it was so long. The process itself is so traumatizing for the survivors because not only do they have to, you know, regurgitate their story and they have to answer the questions in so many different ways with the body cam in front of them, they also have to call the perpetrators to see if they're going to incriminate themselves. So here you are, the survivor, and you're calling your perpetrator to see if they're going to admit on the phone so that they can take that as evidence. Like, that is just wild. Like, and that's still a practice that's used today. You know, and you have to find your own evidence. So it was like, I'm the survivor here, and now I have to be my own detective and investigator, and like it's crazy. So the system is definitely not perfect. There's, you know, a lot of work to be done. So there's just a lot of steps.
And when you had to confront your uncle, did he cooperate or did he? Did he exert his rights?
We didn't get to that point, but there was like this stall. So after the report, there was this stall and they couldn't find like any evidence. And I just remembered it like, oh my gosh, I remember
the letter
in 2014 where I saw him at a funeral and I was going through my Celebrate Recovery program and I used it. I had my sister take a video of me forgiving him. So I think because of that video too, you know, he said, I'm so sorry. And he's crying. And then he ran into his car. I got to use that video as evidence.
Oh, wow. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit, Emerald. No. Yeah. But actually bring it back to the details of your story too. Right now, you're currently a licensed marriage and family therapist. Congratulations
on your
licensure. And you're practicing in the Bay Area, right?
Right.
You mentioned some of the work that you had to do to help heal yourself from these traumatic experiences as you got older. So a lot of the things that you experienced were these things that your parents, you know, advocated for you and they got you this therapy? Was this something that you did on your own, or were these recommendations made from adults in your life that had you do these different programs?
A lot of it was like self-advocacy, you know. So in high school, yeah, because it's just free counseling. You just go up to the, you know, to the wellness center and you get it yourself. You know, when it was Kaiser, at that point, I was an adult. So I did that myself.
Okay.
When it came to an agency. So a lot of it was self-advocating for myself, unfortunately, because my parents didn't know how to get access to these things. But my healing journey with the sexual trauma was like, it was quite a wild one because I was comfortable doing the healing work around like, okay, the abuse with my parents. I was comfortable doing it around my identity as a, you know, as an Asian woman, but like, where I was comfortable doing my healing work around my sobriety, you know, from drugs and alcohol. I'll be 5.5 years sober this year. You know, I'm 5.5 years sober now. But like, the sexual
congratulations.
Thank you. Was the most terrifying. And so I did save that to last. And not because I purposely, just I was terrified. Like, it's a terrifying thing to have to face.
So, yeah.
Like, here I am. I'm doing the work. Like, I'm literally helping clients in a community agency and, you know, and I'm about to, like, I'm holding survivor circles for teenagers and my supervisor kind of calls me out. He's like, hey, like, whenever we talk about court or whenever we talk about this, the sexual trauma clients that you have, I noticed that you look really sad. Like, well, because I don't feel, and I told, like, I don't feel comfortable pushing my clients to go to court. Like, if they're not ready, they're not ready. Like, I don't want to force them to do anything they don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something along the lines of, well, you don't want them to be this 35-year-old person that's just, like, regretting, you know, letting go, letting their repeat offender out there. And I was just like, that was such a milestone, because that, like, broke me. And here I am crying in front of my white supervisor. He's like, oh my gosh, what's happening? What's going on? I'm like, well, because, like, that's me. I'm the 35, you know, year old woman that's regretting letting this repeat offender out there. And so that was the catapult. Like, okay, I'm ready to face this. Like, I don't want to keep running away from this wound anymore. And so that's when, okay, I'm going to make the report. 2021, when all the, you know, API hate crimes against Asians, against women were happening. And then you see the Atlanta shootings and the fetishizing of Asian women. You know, then that's when I became like, no, I can't be silent anymore. And so I actually told my story, and I got to be a voice for, you know, AAPI women that experience sexual violence, that experience DV. And then I got to share my personal story. So I'm literally sharing my story for the first time, like, on stages. And I'm just like, the trauma waves are hitting so hard. But that, and I wouldn't recommend anyone do that, but, like, that's what I did. And, you know, then the following year, I decided, like, well, I'm going to just do Celebrate Recovery again for the third time. And, you know, Celebrate Recovery is a 10-month program, and they meet every week, you know, for 2 hours. And you're pretty much working through your hurts, hangups, and habits. And so it's not just like, oh, drugs, alcohol. It could be like an eating disorder. It could be your sexual trauma. It could be, you know, codependency. And so I just said, I want to primarily focus on my sexual trauma. I want to get to a place where I can truly release and forgive these people, not because I condone what they did, but because I want to move on. Like, I don't want to keep holding on to this heavy baggage anymore. And so mm-hmm. I put myself in that, you know. And then in 2021, when I was going through all the court stuff, I got access to different things, like a victim witness advocate. I got, you know, the parent stress line. That's a free stress line that's open 24/7. And mm-hmm. you need someone to just be a safe place to talk to you. You know, I had that. And then I had my individual therapy. So I was getting access to different things, so that, because it was just hard. Like, this is something that I had never faced my sexual trauma before. I had never, told my story out loud like that. I had never gone to court against my perpetrators. So I was trying to use whatever was going to be available to me. Right. And then in 2022, I decided, like, I want to join a healing circle for myself, even though I'm holding all these healing circles, like, I want for me. And so I found one that was online, and it was hard because they don't have, like, there's no in-person ones in the Bay. I'm me. And I think that is not okay. I think more in-person healing circles need to be happening, like, all over, because, you know, people are just feeling really isolated, and they want connection. They want a network of survivors, and they want a hug, and they want to, you know, they want to be in a room with real people. And so, but I didn't get that. And I settled for the online process. And then in 2022, so here I am, like, I'm doing all these healing circles. I'm speaking at conference and workshops and panels and doing all this stuff and doing my own healing work. But if I'm being real with people, like, I still had a lot of the trauma symptoms. Like, I still had the racing thoughts. I during intimacy, I still had a lot of the flashbacks. Like, I could not be regulated enough to even enjoy intimacy with my husband, which was the saddest thing, because I found my guy, I found my person, we have kids together, and I can't even enjoy this moment with you. It sucked. And so, you know, my husband, he found something that was just so helpful for his journey, and he's also a survivor. And he said, you know, do you want to get, like, prayers for this? And I'm like, at this point, I don't care what it is. Like, I am just desperate. Like, it's not, I was so angry. I'm like, it's not fair. Like, it's not fair that I'm pouring so much of myself. And like, I just want to be healed. I just want to feel free in my own body. Like, I just want to do normal things. I want to feel safe when I'm just walking the dog. Like, is that so hard to ask? And so I was just open, and someone prayed for me, and essentially they were just like, calling things out, like, spirit of trauma, spirit of anger, spirit of unforgiveness, just to get these things out of me. And I tell you, like, after one prayer and deliverance session, like, I just told you all the different types of, services that I put myself into. And this was after one session, like, all those trauma symptoms, like, gone. I mean, I had intimacy the next day, and usually I would see like pictures of rapists and perpetrators. Like, I would get so activated. Like, I pretty much had to perform just to, like, be in the moment. And I had intimacy the next day, and there was nothing. All I saw were just, like, lights and clouds. Like, I've been able to be, like, in my body for the first time, and to, like actually feel sensations. Mm-hmm. So it was wild. And for those that don't know, deliverance, it's a process of being set free from different bondages. And it is, for like believers of Jesus Christ, it's partnering with God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit to like to get these things out of you, whether it's the trauma, the sickness, the anger, the physical, mental manifestations in your body. And so for me, it was a culmination of things. Like, I was that desperate to get the healing that I wanted from all of it, not just the sexual trauma, from like everything.
Right. Wow. I just want to say, Emerald, that sharing your story is just healing for so many people in our community that identify with you and are probably also, saying, yeah, me too, right? I mean, we have the Me Too movement, but within our community, there are people that are listening to this episode and saying silently, or maybe out loud, me too. And they're listening to this episode for reasons to find the courage that you've had to navigate this experience and to find healing. And, we know for our community, there's many cultural barriers that, maybe get in the way of even discussing this type of a topic, let alone giving someone the strength to confront it. And you've been able to harness your own inner strength in all of this, which is respectful, inspiring, and also giving other people the voice in how to even navigate something that has happened similarly to them. And when we talk about some of these cultural barriers like hiya, or bringing shame to oneself or family, these are some of the barriers that even silence many of us when we've had similar experiences to the ones that you're describing, right? So when we talk about cultural barriers, what's your insight on, or what's your take on how someone can overcome some of these cultural barriers or stigmas the way you've been able to? I know it wasn't always easy for you.
I know it's so hard, because it's not just like within the Filipino culture, it's a lot of communities of culture.
Right.
That.
And we have even non-Filipinos listening, as well. And so we've always invited, also, I wanted to say, we always have invited other communities to listen to our episodes, because they're finding these parallel experiences in their communities, right? So.
Right. So some of the things that I've noticed is that our, the Filipino community, we're not talking about mental health. We're not talking about what love is. We're not talking about sex. We're not talking about boundaries, body autonomy, or consent. And so if we're not talking about it within our home, and then we try to navigate it on our own, it's so confusing, because then you're having to figure it out on your own. you know, asking your friends or doing your own research or, you know, listening to a podcast. And so that's the shift that I've been trying to create in, you know, the, not just like Filipino communities, like all communities that I get a chance to be a voice.
Mm-hmm.
That these are the type of conversations that we need to have within the family homes, because that's where it starts. You know, we're creating this blueprint for how to be and how to show up in the world. And we can't just like, do you think that the schools are going to teach it? Do you think that your friends are going to teach it? Like, we need to have these, you know, they can be uncomfortable, but they're very necessary conversations that we need to have. And I think another barrier is that, like I mentioned before, you know, so often the sexual trauma is happening within the family unit, you know, whether it's like an auntie, an uncle, an older cousin or a family friend or the yaya or the neighbor. And so like,
yeah,
we begin to do that. And then so then our secrets are just killing us inside by holding on to it. And, you know, we're carrying on to burdens and shames that are just were never meant for us to hold on to because they've been projected onto us, you know. And then the other barrier is like just the lack of guidance. Like, how do you begin to even bring this up? Where is the manual for that? Like, how do you bring it out? And what I'd say is like, you don't do it alone. I mean, I definitely didn't do it alone. Even when I was doing my court process or even when I was sharing my story on the stage, is like, what I realized, like, there's so much healing within the community. And that's why I like to do healing circles in community, because then it's less scary. And so it's like navigating, well, who are the safe people? Are there safe people within your friend circles? Are there safe people within your pockets of community? Are there safe people within your family that you can start to practice sharing these parts of yourself so that you're not alone in this, you know? Mm-hmm. Because it's really confusing. It's this whole concept of like sex is so confusing. And you wonder why there's so many issues around it, because they get conflicting perspectives around what do the schools say? What do your friends say? What does the culture say? What does the religion say? What does your family say? All of the messages are so conflicting. And then you wonder why, like, how come I'm having such difficulty with intimacy, and not just sexual intimacy, emotional intimacy, physical intimacy, because you're getting such conflicting views. And so I would say, you know, find the safe people. Like, who are those safe people so that you can start to unravel and unveil like who you are and what you're going through. And that way it feels just a little bit safer to do it in a bigger scale.
You know, Emerald, another thing that I heard you say was that your husband was also a victim. Yeah. And I think that's important to also bring out in this episode, because women are not always the only, or female identified individuals, they're not always the only victims in this. So did your experience also influence your husband's advocacy with what he had also experienced?
Yeah, I mean, he just started to share his story like 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that I hear from, like, not only from my husband, but other male clients or even male friends that have opened their story with me, like, well, it's not that big of a deal. Well, it's not as bad as this. There's a lot of comparison. Well, what is it going to matter if I say it out loud? Nothing's going to happen anyway. And so there's a lot of, like, dismissing and just covering it.
So you found that different between your male and identifying and female identified clients?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's already hard to come out with what happened, but I think it has been much easier for, you know, people who identify as female to come out, because mm-hmm. when we do all this, we have the Me Too movement, we have more and more women that are coming out with their stories. It's not the case for men. It's kind of terrifying, because, you know, they have to be like strong, they have to be the protectors, or, you know, these are the messages that they're given. And how terrifying is it for them to say, hey, it was a female that did this to me?
Or even a male.
Yeah.
In some cases, yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, Emerald, what were your first steps in confronting this the silence and the pain? I mean, I know many people in our community, I mentioned earlier, have similar stories, as yours, and maybe they're listening to this to figure out how to even begin or embark on this path towards healing. You mentioned that a lot of this was self-initiated, a lot of the support that you sought. At what point were did you realize that you needed to get help, and where did you even begin? Like, how did you start that journey of saying, "Hey, I need help, and this is where I should start first"?
I mean, are you talking in terms of my sexual trauma or like what, or just in general?
Let's go in general, because I and then we can hone in on your sexual trauma.
It actually wasn't me. Now that you're bringing it up, it actually wasn't me that self-initiated. So, my very first relationship when I was 14, and I think he didn't, and he was actually the Other than my sisters, he was the first person outside of my family that I told what happened to me. And so he did witness like how depressed I was, and he did witness like that I used to, engage in a lot of self-harm and cutting, and he did notice that I had a lot of suicidal thoughts, and he just didn't know what to do. And it was actually him that brought me to the counseling first, and where I got to meet my first counselor, Sandra. And she was half Black, half Filipino, and she had a valise on her walls. I was like, yeah, we're cool. You're my therapist. And she was the first one to teach me the word rape and sexual abuse. And yeah, like I love Sandra. I love Sandra so much.
Wow. Okay, so for some people, like, if they're lucky enough to have a loved one and right advocate for them, do you have any like advice for people that want to take their own journey towards healing? Like, at what point, should they know, hey, this is like a sign, right? That I mean, you also have clients that are, dealing with similar experiences. What are some of their stories and when they knew that they needed to take that step towards getting help and healing?
I think through what I've noticed, it's a lot of these adults, that they thought like, if I just move forward and I just keep moving on and I just keep pursuing my career, my college, it's gonna be fine. And what they're noticing is that some of the symptoms that they're not going away. They're feeling like irritable, agitated. The nightmares are still there. They're not feeling settled. They're chronically activated because they don't feel safe, and they feel like they need to protect themselves, even with, with their significant others, or, they haven't been able to have like regular bowel movements, or, or intimacy is just so painful because they're having like, vaginismus, which is like tightness, or so they say they've moved on, but they're experiencing all these like physical and emotional symptoms in their life, despite. So,
And this was their like sign of like, hey, I need to do something about this.
right, because I think so often people just like they put in the box, and they think like, if I just put in the box and forget about it, and just like, eventually it's gonna go away. It doesn't go away. We just need to safely unbox it and, kind of work through all the different things. Like, hey, what are the lies that I believed about myself that are just absolutely not true? They don't belong in my self-belief system. What are the narratives that I believe that were fed to me, that are impacting the way that I view life? you know, what are the boundaries that broad from me, like, and started to take, you know, to ground in those truths and, you know, start to undo a lot of the harm that was done to you.
So, Emerald, you also mentioned that when you were starting to find healing within this process, you joined a online healing circle. I know that there are members throughout our diaspora that are listening to this episode and trying to find, like you mentioned, a physical space to even gather to talk about these experiences and heal from them. Do you want to mention maybe what that online healing circle was?
You know, obviously there's mine in person in the Bay, but the online one,
yeah,
is Kaleen Khan. Oh, I love her so much. Yeah, Kaleen Khan, Kalene, and her last name is Khan. And so she's also another therapist that has been doing these healing circles and also a fellow survivor. And so that's why I chose her.
So folks can just kind of Google Kaleen Khan and they'll probably find that healing circle.
Yep. Okay. It's one of the few circles that she does. I know the other one she does is like on, I think, perfectionism or burnout. And so, but sexual trauma is also her jam too.
Okay. Now you've been able to transform your experience in a way that you're now offering help to other survivors of sexual trauma within your practice as a LMFT, right? Through your collective healing circles. Tell us more about that process and what it entails.
Yeah, I mean, so I created this 12-week curriculum, and really it's like my gift to the community. It's like everything that I've always wanted in my own healing journey, because I've been through so many, like I told you, Kaiser, community agencies, like, you know, open-ended groups, closed-ended groups. And so these are just things like, man, I wish that I would have had this in my own healing journey. And so this isn't it wasn't anything that I experienced. I just wanted to give it. And so in the first week, I call it like our dream circle, because, you know, so often as survivors, it's terrifying to dream, because then what if it doesn't happen? Or am I even allowed to dream? What are the possibilities? All I know is how to do is survive. And so we get to dream out loud. We get to draw it out, write it out, and share it from other people to inspire each other of, hey, I've always wanted to go to school. I've always wanted to move out of state, or I've always wanted to be in a relationship, or I've always wanted to just like hike a hill, you know, or something small things. I've always wanted to learn how to ride a bike. Like, you know, we get to see that. Like, I want to be a DJ. And so we incur, you know, or I want to write a book. I'm an author in the making. And so there's been a lot of people who've like launched podcasts or wrote their poetry books or the process of writing their books that come out of these healing circles, because, like, you know, like they have their round of survivors that believe in them. And so they're just going to do it, you know? And then the second week is showing them, and I always use, I love Canva. I always like using visuals. We're using visuals. We're using the whiteboard. We're using movement. I use all types of stuff. It's not just talk therapy, because I don't believe in that. I think you need to honor all the different ways that your brain processes information and your lived experiences. And so there's a lot of like writing, physical activities, dance, drawing and authentic sharing. And so screening. And so every week is a different theme. The second week is the impacts of trauma. So we talk about all the different ways that sexual trauma can impact, you know, your relationships, your sense of safety, the way that you've adapted, hope. You know, maybe you've used substances or food to kind of like deal with the pain, or, you know, or even how your awareness around safety. Like for me, I didn't even have those alarms. You know, like when something dangerous is about to happen, you have your alarms. Mm-hmm. You have like, you start to feel the pricklies or you start to feel activated. I didn't have that. And so I found myself repeating these same patterns. And for some people, it's like, it's very hyper alert. Like everything seems dangerous now. So it's really hard to even just exist in the world. And so you tend to isolate. So there's like this spectrum, right? So we talked about all the different ways, you know, that people can be very aversive to sex or very hypersexual, or, you know, hey, how come I'm getting chronic body pain, or how come I'm it's hard for me to speak up. I used to be such a social butterfly, and now it's hard for me to even put a sentence together or even draw a boundary with my boss. And so we talk about the different impacts. And then, you know, week three is owning your story. And so this is, I tell people, like, this is the hardest part of the whole journey, because we write out our story. So they have a week to, you know, to write out what happened. And so they're talking about, like, the name of the perpetrators, what happened to them, the environmental factors that led to it, you know, how has it impacted the different areas of your life, and you know, how do you want to shift your narrative in a way that empowers you and the people around you? And so they're writing out their story, and then they share out loud with the fellow survivors the next week. You know, we go through each week is, okay, now we're healing in the body, healing in the mind, freedom of letting go. Because sometimes the word forgiveness can be so triggering and so activating. And so, you know, whether you want to use release or letting go or forgiveness, it's not condoning what they did, but it's like, I've been holding on to this big baggage and I don't want to do it anymore. I want to let my light, because I deserve to. And, you know, starting to ground yourself. Well, what are my new boundaries? What is a boundary? I used to say, like, we're going to work on boundaries. And then they're like, what's a boundary? Like, okay, I need to back it up, Emerald. I can't assume that is, like, stop. So, yeah, you know, and then starting to make aligned choices. I mean, choices that are aligned with your values versus the people pleasing and, like, going along with what everyone else is doing, but really and standing firm on that, right? And then, you know, I go through the family tree exercise where we dissect your family tree. We write it out and we look at, okay, what are all the things that have been running through that bloodline? You know, medical things, emotional patterns in, you know, parenting, marriage. We look at all that bloodline and we start to see, well, okay, those are the things I can honor and I can acknowledge that this happened. And here's some new generational patterns that I would like to start doing, starting with me. And who knows, maybe I can make an impact with my cousins or my parents, or, you know, the goal isn't to change the whole family tree. It's just like, you start with you and, you know, it could be a ripple effect. Maybe not with your family tree, maybe with your friends. And then really assessing your supports. And so I created this whole, like, it was like 10 questions and you're kind of assessing your supports. Like, well, are they emotionally supported? Do I feel energized around them? Am I motivated to be around them? Do they challenge my growth in some aspect of my life? And so we start to look at, hey, who are the people around me, and are they really what I need? Are they supportive? And so it's not me telling you; you're assessing for yourself. And so, and then how do you create that? Like, what if there's nobody? How do you start to cultivate that? And so we talk about those. And then, you know, we start to explore, like, all the different messages that we got around romance and sex. Like, hey, what did the schools tell us? What did our friends tell us? What did we get from music and books? What did we learn in our family upbringing? What did we learn from our culture? That's not always Filipino culture. There's a lot of, hey, we're a mix of different cultures. And what was the messages around that? And then grounding yourself, like, well, what is true for you? Like, how do you want to operate in romantic relationships? How do you want to flip the dating scripts? Like, what would you like intimacy to look like? And for a lot of people, like, they don't know what that is, because this is what they've known. They've known, you know, trauma, dissociation, performative, or just, like, numb, or, you know, just triggers. And so then how do you begin to shift of, you know, honoring what your body needs, and then getting to a point where, hey, I can have embodied intimacy. I could be in my body. I can be in touch with my sensations. I can have a choice and who I get to have access to me. It's crazy. Crazy. So, and then, you know, the last thing is we get to celebrate, and I let them pick the celebration. Some of them, they want to have a picnic in the park. Some of them, they want to have a potluck in the office. Some of them, one of them, they want to do a break room. So we did a break room and we ranged out. And another one, we did axe throwing. So I let them pick, and then we all celebrate together our journey. And so that's my 12 week.
Wow, that is so cool. Thank you for sharing that process. I'm going to ask you at the end, you know, for people that are like, how do I sign up or where do I sign up? Don't worry, we're going to get to that question. Hang on, you know, stay on with us. So I'm going to ask you, Emerald, you're a parent now. And how, you said you mentioned you have two kids?
Yeah, I have a 14 and, yeah, they're teenagers. Crazy.
So given what you've experienced, because I'm sure we also have parents that are listening to this episode, what are some things that you've instilled in them to protect them and prevent them from ever having experience, you know, having to not experience anything that you have, you and both your spouse have experienced?
Yeah. And you know what? I didn't do perfect. I was a very hyper-vigilant parent because, like I said, like, I didn't start the healing journey with my sexual trauma until 2020. And so I did a lot of things that I feared I would have done differently. Like, but this is, I'm just going to share, be very vulnerable about how I did it. You know, when they were two, they were in daycares. So I can't be there to protect them. So that is when I taught them what good touch and bad touch was. You know, I did let them know sometimes there are scary and tricky people out there that might not want to protect you. And sometimes they are the teachers, and sometimes they are the coaches, and sometimes they are, you know, they can be the pastors or the family friend. Mm-hmm. So I taught them, like, who is, you know, who's okay to touch your, you know, your, help you in the bathroom or touch your private parts. Like, if it's okay, if it's the doctor and they're examining and they're just going to look, that's it. But I'm going to be in the room. So they knew, you know, they start to get that information at age two. And then every single year I would, you know, depending on their age and their stage and their development, then I would give them a little bit more information. And so, you know, when they were in, I taught them about boundaries. I bought books about consent and boundaries. There's a ton on Amazon, you know, mm-hmm. and there's even a book on sexual trauma, and that's for kids. Like, there's little kid books. When they're in elementary school, I taught them about Megan's Law, and I show them how to navigate that website. You know, we live right next to a school, but man, we saw all those little chicken pox dots on the screen of the different perpetrators that were within a half mile radius. So I did teach them that because, you know, we need to be aware of our surroundings. In middle school, I did give them the little whistleblowers. So it's like a little where you pull it and then it alerts, like, if, you know, that you're in danger and you can just run. And so they did have that. You know, when they got phones in high school, yeah, I want your locations on at all times. Like, you need to be like an open, honest communications. You know, we had a lot of talks about, you know, what are healthy relationships? What, we talked about sex. We talked about mental health. Like, I was such an open book when it came to my own journey and my healing journey. So there's no, like, oh, TMI. Like, they knew. I mean, they could ask me anything and I'll answer it to my best of my ability. And if I don't know, like, I don't know, babe, we need to Google, okay? Or ask Siri. We need to do some research because I don't know. So, like, that's the type of mom that I was. I'm just, like, very involved, very open. Yeah.
And then for our community that may not be in the U.S., maybe if you could explain what Megan's Law is?
Megan's Law is a website where, well, when someone is a, it's a website where they have, like, all the registered sex offenders. So if you commit a crime and then, you know, you have to get on that list. And then it shows, you know, their picture, the types of crimes that they were convicted of, and their location. And so, because the community needs to be aware of their, you know, they also deserve to be aware. Because then it also alerts parents, hey, do I want to live there? Or do I want to hang around there? It's, yeah.
Right. So parents that maybe might be hearing this for the first time, just, you can just Google, I'm sure, Megan's Law, and then you can search your area. Now, we're coming to the end of the episode, Emerald. Being that we're a wellness podcast, we typically like to also ask our guests what their wellness routines and self-care practices consist of. You've talked about the various modalities throughout the episode that have helped you to heal from not only sexual trauma, but compounded abuse and trauma. You mentioned domestic violence, right? You also even mentioned physical abuse, emotional, and, you know, and sexual trauma. I know that you also run a fitness and therapy business in partnership with your spouse, Nick. Tell me more about that and what your current wellness routines or self-care practices look like.
Yeah, I mean, last year, I opened up my private practice. Been doing the mental health game like since 2016. And, you know, during the pandemic, we realized, like, man, it's so interconnected, because sometimes I would be in my therapy room, my Zoom room, and we're not talking. We're doing physical activities because they needed to get it out. And then I noticed, like, are they even doing personal training in there? Like, I don't hear any movement. And they're literally just having hour-long conversation. And so, like, we decided to, like, blend both of our worlds where, you know, I literally have a gym. You know, we have our gym. We have the 5 therapy rooms. And we do marriage classes and workshops. And I do healing circles. So it's, like, you know, healing in the mind, body, soul. And healing not only for individuals, but for relationships and for families. And so we're, like, such a systems type.
So your spouse is a personal trainer.
Yeah, so he's a person here. But he says, like, no, I'm a therapist too. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna. He is. They literally tell him everything.
And what are you currently doing? What are your own wellness and self-care practices amongst running a business, being a mom, being a spouse, you know, being a devotee to your church, right? Being running a, you know, healing circle. How do you find time for your own wellness, and what does that look like?
Yeah, I had to create a schedule that works for me. So my first client will be 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock so that I have that big morning bulk to do what I need to do. And so, you know, and the first thing when I get up in my morning, I always, like, I'll have my, it's like, you know, my morning devotionals or, like, my morning prophetic declares. And it's, you know, I'm declaring these things over my life. I'm praying these things over my life. And so the book is called Heavenly Decrees. And so I have my time with God because, like, I don't want to go on my phone and just doom scroll. I that's not the first thing that I want. Like, I'm not getting all this energy from myself. Like, I have to get energy from my source, which for me, it's God, it's Jesus. And so I have to tap in with him first because he's the one that gave me, like, all this energy and creativity and the means to do these things and the capacity to hold space and the grace to be able to hold on to these different stories, because I know that everybody is graced for that. Everyone has a different, you know, calling or purpose in their life. So one, I have to have my time with God. And then, you know, I walk my dog, Faith. She's a Frenchie. And, you know, that's, like, the time. Sometimes, like, it's not always, like, oh, I'm just walking my dog. Like, sometimes I'm crying on those walks. Literally. Sometimes I'm, like, just, like, I'm crying. Sometimes I'm, you know, or I'm just, like, I'm just grateful. Like, wow, there's so many times, like, I should not be here. But I'm literally, like, I see the breath coming out of my mouth that I'm walking this dog. And I'm, like, look at the pretty skies. Like, I'm literally just being so grateful for everything. Like, I have working fingers. I have working toes. I see the cars going by. I see this beautiful sunrise. Like, you know, I start my day like that. You know, then I have my physical activities. So with my kids, like, I think it's so creative. Like, how can I spend time with them? And so I joined the boxing gym with them in January because I'm like, how can we spend time together? And I don't want to be that mom just sitting and waiting for them to be done with their class. Like, heck no, I want to do it with them. And it feels so good. It feels like I'm not one of those girls like, okay, let's take 5 deep breaths and, like, you know, ground ourselves. Like, no, I want to go at it at the on the punching bag. I love me a kickboxing class, the boxing classes, or the little boot camps where you just feel like you're just dead on the floor. You know, waiting for someone to collect yourself. Like, I love that.
Yeah.
You know, so I do that with them, like, 2 to 3 times a week. And then on Fridays, I hula. And so I love hula because it's just, like, It's not the Tahitian, it's the slow where you're telling stories with your hands. And that is like my perfect way to end a Friday, because it's like, it's just like everything just melts into that halal. And, you know, I love being around my hula sisters. And I don't have to tell them about what's going on in my life. I just being around them and dancing with them, like I feel, you know, very connected with my body and with my sisters. And, you know, and then we have a gym. So yeah, I will throw down on the weight training, because I love me a good deadlift. Like, it just, weight training makes me feel so strong, and I love it. I love grunting. I love roaring. I love, you know, just doing like CrossFit stuff. It's just, you know, I love aggressive workouts. But I'm also like, I'm mindful. Like before, when I was such a people pleaser and I was so desperate for love and attention, everybody and anybody could get access to me. And then when I like learned to not do that, and I just became real with who I am and what I need, I'm very mindful, like what gets access to me, like which family members get to spend time with me, which friends I allow, you know, in my space, and how much time I can give. The events that I choose, I don't just say yes to every single event. I'm very mindful. I kind of have to feel it out. Like, do I have capacity for it? Do I have the energy for it? Like, is it going to be beneficial? And, you know, can I handle it? I made sure that I have very fueling connections and not just like these fake frenemies. Like, no, I don't have time. Like, I don't have time to deal with that. So I'm very mindful. And I'm also like, I'm very mindful of what I allow in my mind, because I'm really sensitive. And so, you know, the books that I read, the sermons, you know, anything, even if it's like an educational workshop or podcast, I'm very mindful of what I put into my mind, because it needs to be growing and fueling for me. I can't just have junk, because it just, for me, it doesn't feel good anymore. Like I can't mindlessly binge. Like it doesn't feel good for me anymore. Maybe that's what I did in my 20s. Like I just don't like it. And nature, like I try to get that in. Like obviously I do during my walks, but like I try to get in like at least a couple hikes in the month, because in the Bay there's just so many different ones. Like you can, like 15
minutes. Beautiful hike.
So that's what I do. But the important is like making a schedule that works for me. And you know, I am able to do that now because I own my business. But before, like I was at the hands of corporate, and so it used to be part of the hustle and grind and having, you know, your main job and then your side hustle. And like I learned the hard way, that doesn't work. I landed myself in the hospital because of dehydration and vertigo. And, you know, so then I learned I'm never going to put myself in that predicament. I can't. So that's why I created my schedule in this way where, you know, my first appointment to help a client is 11 or 12. And then, you know, I'll go into like, six, and it's not all the way straight through. There's breaks. And then I end my day with connection with my family. And so where we get to be silly, we get to play games. And yeah, even though they're teenagers, like I still want to play games. They still like to roast each other. They still like to joke, like, you know, just then down with those teenagers, or sometimes they don't want to talk and I just want to be in their presence, or just cuddle with the dog. Like I just end my day with connection. So like starting my day with God, self-care, helping some people, and then end the day of connection. That's kind of my, that's a formula that works for me.
It's beautiful. Emerald, as we begin to close, how can our community find more about your healing circle? And if they have additional questions, how can they contact you?
Yes. So my email is emerald@setfreetherapy.org. You can look me up on Inclusive Therapist, Psychology Today, and Therapy Den. You can follow me on Instagram, Heal with Emerald. So, and then I think that Cheryl will be sharing, you know, you can share my phone number as well.
Okay. And then also, where do they find more about your healing circles?
Yeah. And so if you go on Inclusive Therapist and Psychology Today, it'll share all the information and then ways to sign up. And so they would just have to set up an initial consultation. And I will be exploring the online, because there's a lot of people online that, you know, they can't come to the Bay. They're from the way north or the way south of Cali. And so I am going to be doing that for the next round for online.
Okay. And your business is also in San Jose?
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So San Jose, Bay Area, California. All right. Final words. Is there anything else that you would want our community throughout the diaspora to know when it comes to healing from sexual trauma?
You're not alone, and you are so loved, and you're so worthy, and to just to get in community with other people. We're out there. I thought I was alone, and I thought that I was navigating, and you know, you're navigating all this on your own, but like, once you take that bold step of sharing it, you realize like, oh my goodness, there is a whole army of survivors everywhere, and we don't have to navigate this healing journey alone.
Beautifully said. Thank you, Emerald, for this extremely courageous conversation with our community about healing from sexual trauma and launching our fourth season with such a very powerful topic. We thank you for your courageous transparency, honesty, and inspiring journey, not only towards healing yourself, but also your dedication to the healing of other survivors of sexual trauma. I'm personally in awe and deeply humbled by your committed passion, and we look forward to witnessing your journey unfold and supporting your work in the process. And to our community, our next episode of Season 4 will be on another amazing group in the Bay Area, Sweet Mango Therapy Group, one of the first Filipina-owned group therapy practices in California. This episode will air on Wellness Wednesday, May 15th, just in time for Mental Health Awareness Month. As we close, we'd like to acknowledge once again our guest speaker, Emerald Rubio, our graphic designer and beat maker for our opening and closing track, Richie, our advisors, Allison De La Cruz, Rian De Los Reyes, and Safo Tialogo, our community partners, This Filipino American Life, and all of our community members for your shares and support. As always, we'll share more about our guests' offerings on our Instagram stories and highlights for permanent access with any of their upcoming events. Be sure to follow us at Philippine X and Wellness on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, and on X at Philippine X, the letter N, well, followed by the letters N and S. Don't forget to continue to hit like and subscribe on our Philippine X and Wellness YouTube channel. Thank you always for believing in us. Be well, everyone. Continue to take care of yourselves in each and at each other. Daghang salamat.
Right, salamat. Bye. Thank you.